Kia ora, everyone. I'm Emmeline Paddalstrom from Spacebase, a social enterprise focused on catalyzing the space entrepreneurial ecosystem starting in New Zealand to solve challenges on Earth and beyond. You're listening to the Spacebase podcast. Today, I'm interviewing Daniel McKissack. Daniel is the founder of Celestial Commons, a network devoted to improving public interest and representation in space, ensuring that the journey and the benefits of development are shared by all. Daniel is a Kiwi presently living in Berlin, a writer, researcher, diplomat, and serial founder. He holds a bachelor's degree in political science and a master's in anthropology and sociology. Welcome, Daniel.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks so much for agreeing to be on the podcast. You're originally from New Zealand, but you're now living in Berlin. Yeah. Which part of Aotearoa were you from?
I'm from West Auckland, out in the Waitaka Ranges. Yeah. I would say I live most of my life there, but I don't actually know if it is most of my life anymore. I've been away from home for so long.
So you seem to have traveled extensively. When did you move out from New Zealand?
So I left, I think I was 23. It was about a year after I'd finished my bachelor's studies. Mm-hmm. So I'd worked in development in West Auckland for a little while, primarily education development and refugee assistance. And I was really, really keen to kind of get out and do a whole bunch of travel and hopefully learn a few languages. So it was, you know, rather than the few weeks abroad, it was the old Kiwi overseas experience. Let's disappear for a few years. I didn't realize it would turn into decades, but here we are.
Wow. So how many languages do you speak?
Well, only two and a bit, actually. I mean, that's kind of part of the story is that I had the intention of spending a couple of years in different places and then wound up spending a whole bunch of time in one place, namely Egypt and the Middle East. Yeah.
Wow. Oh, wow. That must be really interesting and exciting. When you were growing up, were you already interested in space?
Very, very much. Yeah. No, I was a huge sci-fi nerd from a very young age. My dad got me a copy of, I may have been too young for it at the time, actually, but he got me a copy of Red Mars for my 13th birthday, the Kim Stanley Robinson book, and I just gobbled that up several times. And then, of course, got the other ones, and then, you know, moved on to Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke and eventually, like, Philip K. Dick and Peter Hamilton and all these guys. So I my whole science fiction universe blew up. And I was a big Star Trek nerd. I just kind of fell asleep listening, not just watching, but kind of like listening to The Next Generation every night. It's my happy place. Yeah, no, absolutely. Huge, huge space fan all the way along. Never particularly technical though. So, you know, was really interested in physics and did physics through high school. Mm-hmm. Could possibly have done physics at university, but I think would have been relegated to middling physicist for the rest of my life if that.
Is there a specific space topic or focus of interest that you kind of like latched onto and you know why you were so interested in science fiction, for example, or Star Trek?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm interested in I'll start with science fiction because I think that's really what got me into it before mm-hmm. before the practical. I mean, obviously really into the practical side of it. But for me, science fiction has always been the best genre because it asks really important questions that aren't necessarily asked by other mm-hmm. genres of popular media. So, you know, it allows us to sort of take elements of society that we see every day and kind of run the clock forward and say, you know, what happens if this becomes dominant or what happens if we do this or, you know, run the different scenarios on all the kinds of questions that we're dealing with at the moment. And you know, mm-hmm. as somebody who's also really interested in philosophy, there are questions that have just been around since the dawn of man, right? Like really fundamental philosophical questions, and are the sorts of questions that never have definitive answers. We just have to keep asking them and coming up with answers to them, and sci-fi is a really, really great medium for that as well, because it doesn't just say, oh, you know, what is freedom, what is justice, what is you know, X, Y, and Z. It says, like, what are they going to be, how will this question change and how will the answer change under these different conditions. So I think that's really interesting, and I also think There's an often underappreciated, you know, obviously not direct, but there is an underappreciated relationship between the creative media and what actually happens in real life. Not to say that any one science fiction story represents the future, but because a lot of people, so many people, particularly technically minded people, you know, read or watch or sci-fi, and then they go out and try and build things and create things and do things, right? That we wind up cutting a path somewhere kind of that zigzags somewhere through the middle of our kind of collective imagination, right? And I think, yeah, it's just a really important thing to acknowledge. So that's a huge fan of science fiction. In terms of space, I mean, the kind of questions that made me choose the path that I've chosen is, as I said, I was a huge fan of Star Trek. I think the world could use a little bit more utopian science fiction every now and again. Everything's a little grim sometimes. Yeah. But for me, the question of Star Trek wasn't just like, how do we make warp drive and how do we, you know, how do we beam ourselves from point A to point B? It was, well, here's this future, this sort of post-scarcity future where people are able to kind of like live and breathe and have freedom to do what they want. This is very much a case of the harm principle applying, you know, like people can do essentially anything as long as they don't rub up against other people's ability to do the same. And it's a utopian idea, but I was asking myself, well, okay, well, what are the kinds of developments that lie in the history of that kind of future, right? Like what are the kinds of social developments? What are the kind of political developments and legal developments and other things? Like what kind of what kind of movements and institutions do we actually need to build? So I became obsessed not just with Star Trek, but also the kind of alternate history, you know, the history of the Star Trek universe. And then like, oh, I found that fascinating. And as a teenager, so I thought, okay, well, that's the kind of stuff that I really want to be thinking about, right? The politics of it all. Not just because I was only ever going to be a middling physicist, but also because I thought it was just one of the more interesting questions.
I mean, personally, I actually think that Star Trek really paints that non-dystopian future that we all want to aspire to. And so, you know, how do we get there? As you mentioned, and it's not just on the science side, but also on the social and political side of things, which goes to my next question, because it's really fascinating that, you know, you studied, you know, policy, sociology, and anthropology, which is normally very different from, you know, the typical space engineer or scientist career pathway of getting into the space industry. But the fact that you are, you know, have activities in the community, how did you connect sort of like your passion for space and your education and work experience into getting into this particular space community?
Well, I think it took a little bit of, it took a while, actually. I mean, I'm 36 now, so I guess you'd say it's taken me at least 15 years, right? It's, you know, because, and I might circle back to this later, because it's one of the problems that I'm actually hoping to address with Celestial Commons. But space alienates a lot of people, right? The sector alienates a lot of people. And I don't mean that as a criticism of the sector or anybody in it. I just mean that like it's a sad fact that it's just kind of the realm of science fiction for so many people. You know, I've mentioned this to you before that I feel like it's kind of engineers, Air Force pilots, and billionaires, right? And that perspective is understandable. Given the kind of developments that have happened and the sort of communities in which those developments have happened. But it's also something that really needs addressing because, we understand that different countries, things that happen in different countries, whether we plan to go there or not, affect our lives directly. Sometimes, right? We're experiencing that right now. The world's becoming more interconnected and things that are happening all over the world directly impact our lives in small and in greater and lesser ways. And this exactly the same is true of space, but for some reason, it just kind of lies beyond the cognitive causal domain for people, right? So I was a victim of that too, I think, you know, relegating it to science fiction, thinking, oh, well, you know, I'm just going to be dreaming about this for the rest of my life. So I could have pursued some sort of association with it, but I was convinced that I could have more of an impact in other areas, like the sort of social sciences and politics and things. And I guess, but in the back of my head, I always had, well, like, you know, I read, this is probably 8 years ago now, 6 years ago, maybe, I can't remember what year it was published. But, you know, Commander Chris Hadfield wrote a book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. And I remember one of the key messages that I got out of that book, I found quite affirming. He was saying when he was trying to be an astronaut, think of him, imagine himself as an astronaut and what decisions would that person have made? Mm. You kind of think about it retrospectively, right? Like which direction would they have turned left or right? Would they have like done this or done that?
Right.
And you kind of like, you set like a ridiculous goal, right? So a political social scientist trying to be involved in the space sector somehow, you set this the ridiculous goal and then you think, oh, okay, well, given that, which direction do I go? You know, which decision do I take? It's like, I think sometimes the first and most important step to doing something is deciding that you're going to do it, and then it kind of subtly rearranges all the decision mechanics in your head going forward. So, yeah, I was it took me a decade and a bit, but the whole time I was in the back of my head, I was thinking, oh, well, you know, I'd love to get involved in space somehow. So I wonder how I can put A and B together and B and C together, you know, and so forth. So if you looked at my CV, looked at my career, it would be a very, very chaotic. But through the whole thing, there's somebody thinking, oh, God, I'd love to have something to do with space one day. Yeah.
Yeah. So can you give a little bit more examples of how that materialized either in, you know, even just the small projects that you've done or activities that kind of like led to Celestial Commons, which we'll talk about like in a bit.
Yeah. Key areas of democratic governance, like innovation and democracy. So understanding, because I obviously think that's an incredibly important part, not just of contemporary politics, but not resting on our laurels, rethinking it, innovating it, and making sure we're always improving it, because it's in a fundamentally imperfect system. It just happens to be better than the rest, right? So it's all about like managing an incredibly complex, almost infinitely complex system in which, you know, as individuals, we're all infinitely complex, and then we all have to work together somehow, right? So it's this incredibly complex thing, and we have to make it all, we always have to make it better. And then there's information systems. So, you know, how do we create information? How do we create trust in information? And how do we, you know, improve our capacity to form consensus? I think if I was to rank the challenges in the world that humanity faces, I think, you know, above climate change and above like a lot of things, and not to diminish the importance or threat of climate change, but above them all, for me personally, is an information management problem. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we have shifted into this environment now where rather than just kind of threading a few threads of information together into a narrative, right, which is what we have done for centuries/millennia, for better or worse. Like, we've told ourselves stories, or we've been given stories, again, for better or worse, that have helped us through chaotic and difficult times. Now it's kind of like, well, you've got to, here's a billion threads of information. You've got to somehow weave them into a tapestry that makes sense. You know, all those core questions about who you are and who I am, who you are, how the world works, what my place in it is, they become excruciatingly difficult to answer for everybody. And we've got, you know, associated with that, a big mental health crisis as well. And so, yeah, I think if we want to be able to address problems together and do big things together, we have to be able to form consensus, and we have to be able to create reliable information. We had a big burst of improvement in that like half a millennia ago with the scientific revolution. Now it's the circumstances of change. We've got to find new ways to do that. So that's been another thing, like democracy, information management, and transparency is another one. And you know, just generally, I mean, for me, understanding people and understanding social relations, and there's a whole bunch of other bits and pieces, you know, education and things. So you know, I started off, as I said, doing development projects, education development projects. I went abroad. I initially went to the Middle East after a bunch of travel, and I found myself in Cairo a few months before the Arab Spring Revolution started. And I'd always intended to like do some grad study looking at democracy more closely. And then this revolution kicked off and I thought, well, you know, there's not much point in going anywhere else to do this. I might as well stick around. So yeah, I did. I stuck around and I spent the next, pardon me, a better part of the next 5 years obviously learning Arabic, and my research revolved around the kind of social infrastructure underpinning democracy. So I wanted to know what sustained democracy. And what I found at the time was, I remember a fairly well-regarded politics professor when it first started saying something to the effect of, oh, well, you know, we couldn't have been expected to see this coming. And I thought, well, why the hell not? You know, and it's simply a matter of the excuses that we're given, where that we're just like, we were thinking in different terms, you know, thinking in the units of measurement in the political sciences were just totally off base. We're not off base, but they just weren't inclusive enough. They weren't complex enough to be able to understand what was going on. And I should mention as well, because I know you probably have quite a technical audience, that as a social scientist, I think that one of the most important aspects of a social scientist is a sense of self-awareness. You know, you always got to understand that basically everything you say is some degree of bullshit, right? It's all just like a different, it's all, I hope you don't mind me saying that, but it's all, you know, different magnifying glasses, lenses. It's like attaching a different lens to your telescope, you know, that it does something different. It allows you to see things in a different way and understand certain things in a different way, but there's not really an absolutist or an absolute truth when it comes to the social sciences. So yeah, self-awareness is important. I heard this and I was like, what? Why? And so I thought the thing that was missing was like seeing it at the level of basic human interaction, right? Because the revolution had been triggered by a whole bunch of people coming into the same space, whether it's physical or digital, and actually meeting each other for the first time in decades/centuries and really having conversations and understanding, oh my gosh, you know, you believe this, I believe this, wow, we had no idea. And just the everything that came out of that. And because it had been under the surface, sort of boiling under the surface for so long, and the lid had been kept on the pot for so long, when it burst out, the first reaction was like, oh, this is amazing. We're all getting to know each other. Let's overthrow the government. Let's have a democracy, right? But then because it had been boiling for so long, all of this misunderstanding had come out as well. Like everybody, it's so easy for the collective to agree that they don't like something. And then it's very difficult for them to agree what they do like net or what they want to replace it, right? And so that really highlighted to me the importance of the kinds of social networks, and you know, I called it at the time sort of morphology or the geometry of social relationships that actually sustained democratic society under the surface. So that became like a real focus for me. And I think going forward, it's also probably what I want my contribution in sort of an academic sense to the space sector to be, because I feel like there's, I might get into that in a bit, but I feel like there's applications for that, you know, migrating upwards and thinking about building societies elsewhere, particularly ones that are far removed, remote, and expecting to operate under similar political umbrellas. So I stuck around. I spent 5 years interviewing people and mapping things and mapping changes, and it was really interesting. I went from there into diplomacy, because I'd always wanted to be a diplomat, and I loved, I think it was again Star Trek or Jean-Luc Picard. I was the kid that wanted to be a diplomat because of Star Trek instead of a physicist. So I went and did that for a few years, and then I went back and did more research, and I did some other projects, and I did, I started a media transparency startup with a bunch of journalists, which is, we tried to, as I mentioned, you know, half a millennia ago, we had this revolution, and we were able to sort of, you know, when the printing press first was invented, information, we've got a similar problem that what we're experiencing now, right? Yeah, the printing press was invented, information exploded, disinformation exploded, institutions tried to you know, control it and say what was true and what was not true, and ultimately it just blew up in their faces. And the thing that actually made the difference was a referencing system, like, you know, being able to say, well, this information came from here, right? A level of authenticity and honesty. Mm. So we thought, well, how do we do that for the digital age? We came up with a video bibliographic system where people could kind of like literally narrate their own references as they're doing their journalistic research, and then kind of embed a video highlight reel of references in their story or in their article or what have you as they go. So I did that for the last 4 years, and then I started this. I ran a bunch of workshops all over the place in liquid democracy, and now I'm doing Celestial Commons because I felt like about a year ago I felt like, okay, you know, I'm getting a sense of this now. I feel like I started with how do I get into the space sector. I'd love to do all of these different things, but what's the thing that's missing? What's the thing that I feel is like I can best contribute, and the kind of the network that I have, I can kind of bring it together in the most effective way. And this, you know, as you sort of think about these things more and more, they become more crystallized and focused. And yeah, we got down to this idea that this overcoming this issue with public perception and narrative, right? Like making it clear that there's that interconnectivity, that what happens in space affects people, and that they should all have something to do with it. Because yeah, so
it's great to actually hear the history of your thinking and how it kind of all comes down to the present time where you've now founded Celestial Commons. So yeah, I would love to hear more about, you know, when you founded it, as you mentioned, kind of like the motivations, and what are the short-term and medium-term goals for Celestial Commons, and what are the activities that you're currently working on?
Yeah, sure. So as I mentioned, the primary objective is around shifting the narrative and engaging the public, making it clear that there is that relationship that I mentioned, improving representation in the space sector, and I guess more long term, making sure the public interest as we sort of work together with more sort of segments of the general public, civil society, and so forth, that those ideas are represented in decision-making processes as well, that like decisions about space aren't taking place entirely within a sort of not isolated community, but certainly a community that is not like that isn't representative of necessarily wider public perceptions. Again, not the fault of that sector, because again, the other public perception is kind of walls themselves off from it as well, right? It's not a political issue. Short term, what we're focused mainly on is media and comms. So crafting and telling a different story. That means working with members of the, or you know, people in the space sector to tell human interest stories about space. So, you know, more than just the scientific and technological developments and the engineering achievements. As fabulous as those are, you know, stories about how things in space are positively or negatively, in some cases, affecting life on Earth and why it matters. So, you know, worked with a number of different partners across the world, actually, to tell stories. We're doing more and more of that, kind of interviewing a couple of people a week at the moment, and growing an early network of comms people and sort of storytellers, some of which who have a background in space, but not all, you know. So also people who have just worked in, you know, things like community organizations, who have really, really strong roots in the community in different parts of the world. And, you know, also people who have worked for larger intergovernmental organizations such as the UN and stuff, who have big media networks. So hoping to tell a lot more stories about a lot more human interest aspects of space development. That's the short term. We also run the odd event. We've partnered with a few organizations to run small events. Hope we get the opportunity to do one with you as well.
Is that all like physical events or online events?
Unfortunately, it's been online only so okay. far. Yeah. But the medium term goal is to do in-person events. And, you know, I've been called up on this a couple of times, the people saying, and I'm going to describe the events that I imagine with my colleagues to people in the sector. And they're like, oh, we've got this big conference, this big, you know, astronomy conference or you know, space sector conference, very industry led. And my counterpoint is that they say they worry that there might be an overlap, and I don't think there is. And I'd love for somebody to tell me if there is a strong example of this, like genuinely, because I don't like the idea of working in competition. I think we should all be working in cooperation as much as possible, right? And part of what I've tried to do with this is to find the space that's not already occupied. So, but I don't see large events that really throw the doors open to the general public and bring people in and say, like, basically anybody who has an interest in space, but again, feels that sense of alienation, to come in the doors and to have to be part of conversations about the future of space exploration and space development, to learn things, right? Like I'm doing at the moment. I mean, I've come into this, there's a huge amount that I do not know, infinite amount that I do not know. I've had really interesting conversations with like engineers and space lawyers and all sorts of different people. And I want the public to have those sorts of opportunities as well, right? In person. To feel like that it's not just this realm of science fiction, that it's really happening and real people are involved in it. And so those are the kinds of events that I would love to host, either in New Zealand or internationally. So I mean, that's the kind of conversations that I'm having at the moment, is trying to line up partners and other people or groups who are interested in putting something like this together. And, you know, we've got events that we might model it on, but it would be a combination of policy and politics and industry and science, and then basically just saying, you know, we've paid for the venue, the doors are open, we can have 1,000 or so people come in the door each day for 2 or 3 days and like be part of these conversations and these different discussions. So yeah, that I think those sorts of events I think are really, really important. And obviously not exclusive online events either, right? We do the same online because that, in many ways, that's more accessible. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a mixture of things. Long term, it's partnering with organizations that are developing policy and thinking about the legal and policy aspect of it. And hopefully by this point, we have a network that is competent and legitimate in its sort of representation of public interest groups in the space sector, so that we can work together with those organizations who are looking at policy and law and say, well, like, this is what the general public is feeling, right? Like this is how we get people, this is how we represent people's interests in the law. And, you know, ultimately we need to make, if we want effective policy, not just in any one country, but globally, it is kind of a little bit like climate change in a sense. You know, you've got to make it a political issue, right?
And
people are not going to, politicians are not going to pass laws that represent the public interest unless the public actually, you know, audibly, visibly cares about it and can be seen caring about it. And so that's the kind of momentum that we want to build. Again, not coming in at this as policy experts, wanting to work with people who are policy experts to help formulate that policy. And then I guess super long term, I really, 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 I think the best possible way, this is me getting way ahead of myself now, really, really dreamy, is I think the best way to get people directly involved in space is to put it in their hands, right? Yeah. I mean, we've already seen an explosion of technological capacity and the accessibility of space technology in the last few years, just a massive explosion. It's really impressive. The more I come into contact with it, the more impressed I get. And I think that the natural, not end point, but the natural trajectory of that is to make sure it can go into everybody's hands. I would love to see people with, you know, direct access to satellites or, you know, or chipsets or what have you, direct access to things that are happening on other worlds in their pockets, right? Yeah. And even shared ownership of it. So I'm a huge fan of cooperatives. I've worked in a number of capacities to help form cooperatives, and certainly worked on the governance structures that underpin cooperatives. I would love to be involved in that kind of thing. And I think that's probably my long-term goal. Yeah. Again, another really long-winded answer for you.
No, that's really great and fascinating. And speaking of policy, I don't know if you saw the new space strategy that the New Zealand Space Agency has put out just recently. Basically, they're putting a call out to everybody to actually review and make comments on Have you seen this announced?
I heard about it. Yeah, I mean, is it the same sort of thing that I have? Because I haven't lived in New Zealand in a long time, but unfortunately, but it's similar to what they did with the Policing Act years and years ago, I think.
Probably.
Where they sort of put it out to the public for suggestions and review and things like this, so everybody could make notes, and then they got a committee together to kind of go comb through it all and put something together. Yeah, like fantastic.
Yeah, so it's been going on for quite a bit. I mean, they put out sort of a call out to the space community first, or aerospace community first, to give some insights, like, I mean, starting from like 2 years ago up to now. And then now there's a draft and it's now gone. It's now going out to the public for comments and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I guess related to that, I guess any thoughts on at least your personal view? I know you're not in New Zealand anymore, but do you have any thoughts on where you want to see the New Zealand space industry and community, kind of like what the direction you want it to go for the future?
Yeah, I mean, conscious of the fact that I don't have probably enough foundational knowledge about it to comment on it too acutely, I would like to see a New Zealand space agency that is independent and that has the resources to operate independently, perhaps even by MBIE, and take initiative and sort of dream big, basically. I mean, I think, and part of this is a public perception issue as well, public narrative issue. Like every time you talk about spending money on space, the hit back is always, oh, well, you know, there's so much problems here on Earth that we need to deal with first, right?
Yeah.
And I have a number of issues with that. First of all, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think it's a false choice scenario that has kind of been painted on over the last few decades. You know, we pit good against good, while average and often terrible is able to kind of do as it pleases. And I mean, it's less so in New Zealand, but certainly internationally. You know, we waste a lot of money on things that we shouldn't. Secondly, the return on investment, even if you think about it in a purely economic terms, right, the return on investment is enormous.
Yeah.
And space is worth the investment, whether that's private investment or public investment. It is absolutely worth the investment, not just in economic terms, but certainly if you only want to think about it in economic terms, it's still massively worth the investment. And that's not just in the assistance that like filters out to the private sector and to startup companies, grants and all this kind of stuff. It's you know, cultivating a foothold in the future, right? I mean, you know, it's we think about, and it's possible to think about this in very negative terms. It's very easy, and very often we should, but things like primary resources, logistics, and tech have granted enormous wealth and power to those who wield them in the past. And you combine all three, and that's what empires are made of, right? Mm. I'm not saying New Zealand should become an empire, by the way. What I'm saying is that those three things are inevitably, as certainly as environmental regulation on Earth rightly tightens, and access to space becomes easier, and we get this confluence of different circumstances and policy and approaches, you know, space is going to become an enormous deal, right? And I think that it goes another thing that kind of goes underappreciated, that it's just going to touch everything.
Yeah.
And I know that this is what you guys deal with in your work as well. You kind of go around like talking to businesses and being like, by the way, space is going to touch everything. How do you prepare yourself for that?
Yeah.
How do you adapt to that? Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true. Logistics, primary resources, tech, communications, the whole nine yards. And so having a part of that is so important, you know, like staying out of it. It's like staying out of the IT revolution, right?
Or right.
Modern telecommunications. It's just like, yeah. So every dollar we put towards it is worth it by an order of magnitude. And if we want to talk about the sort of play against, you know, which is often happens, unfortunately, it's been also amongst my lefty colleagues that, you know, why don't we spend it on healthcare or education? Or da, 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 da. It's like, well, yeah, we should do that too. It's not this again. This is not a binary choice. And there is a ripple effect from expenditure in any one area to others, mm-hmm. right? And so if you think about it, you go beyond thinking about it one or two dimensionally, and you start to think about the big picture. Well, yeah, all of this plays into each other. And yeah. even if you want to come at it from that sort of take away the optimistic angle to it and think about it in terms of a preventative measure. The lefty politician is going to come out of me now. And you want to think about it in terms of averting like all these crises that you worry about on Earth, such as like we all worry about, like runaway climate change, for example, massive income inequality, mm-hmm. and things like this. Well, I tell you what, if we just go ahead believing that space is for billionaires, that's exactly what it will become. And, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in the purest sense. And so, if you're worried about income inequality now, just you wait until the collective wealth and power of prime resources, logistics, tech, communications, not just on a planetary scale, but on a multi-planetary scale, is owned by a handful of people and corporations, yeah. then come back and worry about income inequality, right? Yeah. So yeah, we absolutely should be doing as much as we possibly can. So whatever angle you want to come at it from, it just makes good sense. So yes, New Zealand should absolutely, to circle back to your question, sorry. Yes, New Zealand should have an independent space agency that is bold and that has a clear strategy and that is doing things and is building things and is working collaboratively with as many other countries and institutions and companies as it can, should be supporting other people and companies to come to New Zealand. It should be treating this as a big part of its future, because if we're also quite frank, as much as New Zealand owes a lot of its economic success to certain industries, there are sustainability issues with a lot of New Zealand's mm-hmm. Economic pillars. Yep. And we need to be thinking long term about what can stand in its place, right? And take on a lot more of the weight. Yeah. That's awesome.
That's great. Yeah. So going back to Celestial Commons, you talked about a lot of the activities that you're working on. So how can Kiwis participate or how can they find you online?
There's a whole bunch of different ways. We just started a Twitter account, so please don't, we've got bugger all followers on Twitter. But come follow, find us on LinkedIn, email me, daniel@celestialcommons.org. You can find our website, celestialcommons.org. You can please reach out to me directly. I would love to find some way to collaborate. Whether you're an individual that just wants to be involved, whether you want to help reach out further into communities in New Zealand that are unrepresented or underrepresented in space and the decision-making process. It does not matter how much expertise you have, right? This is just an important subject to sort of grow awareness in. Again, long-term, medium-term even, we want to make it an issue that people think about and that consider the future of, because it's going to be important to all of us. And we will find something to do together, right? Whether it's an event in the community, whether it's an online event, whether it's helping pitch, write, or place an article domestically or internationally, please reach out. Let's grow this thing, right?
That's awesome. My last set of questions is really more on your personal recommendations, especially because, as I mentioned, you've got a very different background. And most people, again, are always afraid of getting into the industry because they think that they don't have the background or the education. Can you recommend to someone in the audience, kind of like, what is the first steps that they could potentially be involved in or what they could do to enter in the industry the same way that you've done it?
Well, I think, first of all, that it's inevitable that everybody is, I think anybody who's sort of remotely self-aware comes up against imposter syndrome, right? And think that is certainly the case going into the space sector. I felt imposter syndrome numerous times during my life, almost persistently all the way through my life, actually. And it's obviously going to be the case coming in here. I know it's a difficult impulse. It's a difficult feeling to kind of battle, and sometimes feel like you got sort of arrogance on the one hand, and you know, you sort of feeling like, you know, oh, maybe I'm just, I shouldn't be the one to do this. Maybe this is not me. Maybe the, you know, who am I? These kinds of emotions. So just start off by learning as much as you could, like, you know, being honest with yourself, which I think feeling like an imposter sometimes is, right? And reaching out to people online and asking to meet with them and ask questions and learn more. Come at it with a sense of humility and find what you can do best, what you can, because it's going to be such a huge thing, right? There is a place for everybody. There is literally, if you could tell me whatever your background is and whatever your life experience is and whatever your professional experience is, I guarantee I could think of something to do with space that is going to require your skill set and your knowledge.
If there's any specific resources that you particularly always default to that you want to share with others?
Well, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the platform, but I personally just use LinkedIn to kind of like leapfrog contacts, basically, and just kind of reach out to people that way. I was lucky enough to know a few people internationally who could make connections for me early on through previous bits of work. But, you know, you can just like reach out to people cold sometimes. On LinkedIn, and once you get one, I mean, I found that every conversation I've had with anybody, they've been like, oh, well, you should speak to these two or three other people. And so it just kind of spirals from there. So I think, you know, that for, I say that, but also at the same time, I have to acknowledge, again, from personal experience, as a sort of introvert that's forced into self to become an extrovert over the last 20 years, that it can be a real challenge and real like difficult reaching out to people in the first place. So if you need help with that, please reach out to me.
So yeah, before we close, do you have any parting words, words of wisdom that you want to impart to the audience?
Look, I think don't think about where things are now. Think about where they're going to be. Imagine a positive future, right? And then work backwards from that. I think you know, it's something I've always tried to do. One of my close friends once called me a belligerent optimist, which is a brand I've kind of taken on board, put it on a business card once. I think I put it on my blog another time. And I don't mean to imply that makes me a grumpy bastard, but like I think it makes me, the belligerence aspect of it means that like, yes, a lot of things are terrible, but if we just kind of settle for that and we resign ourselves to it, then nothing will ever change, right? So start by imagining an optimistic future, work way back from that, and imagine, you know, what is that optimistic future going to require, right? It's going to require everybody, and everybody doing a whole like infinite numbers of different amazing things. And there is a place for everybody in that optimistic future. And we have to think in those terms to actually make it a reality. So,
wow.
That's
awesome to close, actually. Thank you so much, Daniel, for being on the interview and for sharing your experiences and insights, specifically to the New Zealand community, but also beyond.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you like Space Base's work and would like to support us, please check us out at spacebase.co. Thanks for listening and see you next time.